Now, it does take a bit of courage because increasingly, if you're going to recognize that the pills cause a problem, you're going to be going against the standard of care. And the people who run the health service business that you're working in may figure that this guy's not keeping to the standards of care. This is dangerous. We're going to have to get rid of him. So that's the problem doctors are up against. But it's becoming a case of do I get sacked today or do I get sacked tomorrow, basically. So.
Hello, critical thinkers. Welcome to this new episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Here we question the conventional, explore the unconventional, and seek truth in health and wellness. I'm your host, Mike Vera, board certified health and wellness coach and founder of Avantia Health Optimization. Today we're talking with someone who's really a hero of mine. His name is Dr. David Healy, and he was one of the first people to really wake me up. Especially in the field of medicine. He wrote a book called Pharmageddon that I started reading in 2012 while I was going through my college years to become either a clinical psychiatrist or psychologist, something with the mind. And I'm reading his book, and it totally cracked open the system, and it exposed how doctors are influenced with statistical trickery and manipulation of the data and having other people write reports on studies. And I can go on and on. And I mean, with excruciating detail and citations and resources, just laying it all out. And I had to reorient. I had to change my trajectory of where I was headed because I was so disillusioned about the field that I was pursuing. And thanks to him, that's a big part of why I became a health and wellness coach. So in this episode, we do talk a lot about the themes from that book, Pharmageddon. And he's written many books, but that one was my favorite. So we talk about how doctors are propagandized. We talk about the harms of antidepressants and how the pharmaceutical industry has lied about those harms and some of the implications and even some of the alternatives like psychedelics and a whole lot of other really cool stuff to dive into. So let me quickly tell you a little bit more about Dr. David Healy. He is a world-renowned psychiatrist, scientist, and psychopharmacologist, former professor of psychiatry at universities in Wales and McMaster University in Canada. He studied medicine in Dublin and Cambridge University. He's authored over 230 peer-reviewed articles and 25 books, including notable titles like The Antidepressant Era and Pharmageddon. One of his latest books, Shipwreck of the Singular, discusses the decline in healthcare quality and its impact on life expectancy. He's the founder and CEO of Data-Based Medicine Limited, which runs risk.org, a platform for reporting drug side effects directly by patients. And there is a link to that in the show notes. I highly recommend checking out that site. So lots of good stuff in this episode. And without further ado, here we go. How would you say doctors are targeted with pharmaceutical propaganda?
That's an extremely interesting question. And I think back in 1951 or so, when a bunch of new drugs came out, okay, it seemed a good idea to the politicians, and it also seemed a good idea to the pharmaceutical industry to make doctors the people that gave you these drugs. You could only get them through people like us. They were on prescription only, okay, which had been introduced in 1914 for heroin and cocaine. And there is a little bit of a feeling I have, at least if I go to a doctor, that they're treating me like an addict, in a sense. They're checking if I really want this or whatever, or if they think I should have it or whatever, which makes you feel that maybe perhaps you've done something wrong, okay? But the idea behind it, the good idea behind it was the doctor, me in this case, let's say I'm treating you. The idea was that I'm supposed to risk manage things for you, to keep an eye, maybe let you know that, yeah, you're asking for this tricky drug for a kind of a condition that's maybe mild. You've got a little bit of acne and you're asking for Accutane, which can be really helpful. It can work wonders, but there are other ways to cure a little bit of acne. And Accutane can come with some pretty awful problems, okay? So do you really want to take it? I mean, that's the kind of question that I should be posing you. And also, the other big question, I think, is when you actually come back to me and you say that you've actually had a problem on some pill that I gave you. Now, partly because I make you feel like you're doing something wrong to come and ask for pills at all in the first place. When things go wrong with a pill, you're a bit nervous about coming back. This guy didn't think I should be on it, or you felt that he didn't think I should be on it. And he's not going to be kind of sympathetic to the idea that things aren't working out the way he hoped they would when he gave you this pill. But anyway, you actually come back and let me know that things have gone wrong with the pill. Now, in terms of managing the risk for you, I should be there agreeing with you. I mean, for the most part, there will be people who will come along and claim that they're having things happen to them on the pills that this pill can't cause. But for the most part, if you're not right, you're the one who has the pills. You're the one who's in a privileged position to know that things aren't right. You may not be sure quite what's wrong, but if you're there figuring things aren't right and you come back to me and I'm supposed to be managing risks, my job really is to work with you to work out what's going on and to agree with you that the pill is actually causing the problem, if it is, or if there's any chance that it is, okay? But that's not what happens these days. And almost any drug you care to think of, but the one that's the easiest for people to understand is, do antidepressants cause you to become suicidal? Okay, so I give you an antidepressant and you come back because you're feeling wrong and agitated and things like that. And if you'd taken an antihistamine that was over the counter, and some of them can be serotonin reuptake inhibiting, they can be SSRIs and they can make you agitated. And if you kept taking them when you're feeling wrong, they can make you suicidal, okay? But if you take an antihistamine from over the counter and you feel bad, you stop it. You use your own judgment and you stop it. If you come to me and you're on an antidepressant, it used to be the case 30 years ago when the SSRIs came out first. You'd come along and say, this isn't suiting me. And I'd agree and we'd halt it and say, there's loads of different kinds of pills that we can try. They don't all work out the same way. But that's not what happens now. You're much more likely to hear, oh no, antidepressants can cause that. Even if they've got a black box warning, you're going to hear from me, no, antidepressants don't cause that. That's just a may contain nuts label. The companies are putting it there and the regulators put it there to cover their backs. Okay. Your illness is worse than I thought, and we need to double the dose of this pill. Now, left to your own devices, you'll be able to work out what to do. Caught in a relationship with me, you're trapped. Now, I'm not managing the risks awfully well. And this comes back to what you asked me. It's this long way around to answer the question, but you asked the key question almost, which is, how do the pharmaceutical companies influence me? And forget the free lunches and the freebies and the adverts in journals. A bunch of doctors came out 30 odd years ago when Prozac came out first and said, hey, we gave Prozac to a bunch of people and they became suicidal on it. And you halt the drug and the problem clears up. You put them back in the drug, the problem comes back. And they were able to tell us, hey, doc, I've been suicidal before, but this was different. I could tell the difference between what the pill was doing and what the illness has been doing before. And there was no other way to explain what was actually happening. Okay. So the American Journal of Psychiatry published that article and other big journals published the same kind of articles from a bunch of different people. It was pretty clear SSRIs make you suicide. Okay. But the industry responded with articles saying we've looked at our clinical trials and there's no evidence from our clinical trials that these drugs make you suicidal. What your doctor said, what the patient's saying is just anecdotal. The science shows the drug can't do it, okay? Now, that's very much the tobacco company argument. Doubt is our product. They cast doubt on the whole thing. There's common sense on the one side. There's what looks like the science on the other side. Now, it turns out that the science, the company trials, are all ghostwritten. They're often negative trials published as positive. In the best journals, you've got trials which showed the drug didn't work, caused kids or people to become suicidal, very good journals take an article that's ghostwritten and says the drug worked wonderfully well, was completely safe, and they get published, and they get built into the guidelines. And the average doctor really hasn't got the time to check all these articles out from years and years ago. They read the guidelines, okay? And the guidelines don't say that antidepressants cause you to commit suicide. The guidelines just say, yes, the antidepressants work, and there you can switch from one antidepressant to a different antidepressant. I mean, from one SSRI to a different SSRI, which would be like you with an SSRI antihistamine. You go on one and you feel suicidal. You're not going to try a similar antihistamine, okay? But that's increasingly what doctors do. If you say, look, could the drug be causing it? They say, absolutely not. And this isn't just this problem. It's almost all problems on all pills these days. And what's going on is the companies have persuaded the FDA to be risk communicators. And FDA are there thinking there's benefits to these pills and there's risks to these pills. Do we tell people about the risks and put them off getting the benefits? Ooh, we might kill more people if we deter them from taking the pills, okay? Which in a way is fine if you can just look at the adverts to the public and could control those and not mention the risk. But if you're making it hard for the risk manager, the person who should be aware that, yeah, absolutely, this can make you suicidal. So if you come back and tell me you're feeling worse, one of my options should be the pill could be doing it, and we may need to stop it rather than double the dose. And just come back to the more ordinary company language. People complain about a few things like the free lunches and say that's what the problem is. And I'm saying to you, no, it's the ghostwritten trials and the no access to the data. They also complain about there's direct-to-consumer adverts in the United States and New Zealand. The rest of the world's kind of sensible. They don't go that way. But in actual fact, the clinical trials published in the New England Journal of Medicine and JAMA and the American Journal of Psychiatry are direct-to-consumer adverts because when the industry looks at the situation, they look at you and me and they see you put a pill in your mouth, but they see me as the consumer. These are the direct-to-consumer adverts, which are global. Every country in the world, every doctor, everywhere is influenced by them. And industry's job is to make sure I don't have any side effects. It's to make sure that when bad things happen to you, that I don't see it. I see the illness getting worse and I give you more pills. I don't see the drug could be causing the problem and we need to take the pill away. So if you look at the guidelines, if you look at the articles, all the best articles in all the best journals, and if you look at the media, a lot of the media have got the same message from CBS, 60 Minutes, all the programs, the BBC over in Europe and things like that. They've all got the same message. We used to be able to make programs about the hazards of pills. Now, if I go along and say, look, there's this real hazard about you take antidepressants, they can wipe out your ability to make love for the rest of your life, even after you've stopped them, okay? They say, yeah, that sounds like a good story. And sex, yeah, great stuff to talk about. But we don't want to put people off taking their pills. It's not really responsible. So they've got the same message as well. And it means that increasingly, doctors just don't see it when things go wrong. And if you say, look, it's clearly going wrong, they say, oh, no, that's in the small print. It could happen in 1 in a million people. But I've got to say, common things are common. And it's just you've got this terrible illness. It's getting worse. And that's what we need to give you more pills. So, yep.
It seemed like from the way you describe that, it seems like a lot of the research out there is packaged to really function as advertising. And you even described the media relationship there, too, where these pharmaceutical companies are giving the media a lot of money. And that makes them hesitant to talk about some of these risks because then they might pull the advertising. So I guess to what extent can we trust these pharmaceutical companies, the regulatory agencies, the research in general?
The answer is you can't. Back 30 years ago, when I entered the field, you could. Things have changed and it's got to the point where you really can't trust anything at all. And among the few people that I can trust is you, if you come along and say to me, I'm on this pill and things have happened. That's almost the only thing I can go by. If I look at the academic literature, if I look at the guidelines and things like that, if I look at what the regulators are doing, in good faith, maybe, okay, maybe the FDA are there thinking that they're doing the right thing. They are trying to, I mean, people's lives may be lost because they don't come clean about the risks, but their thinking is more lives will be lost if we put you all going along for treatment. Okay. So maybe that's the case, but ultimately it means you can't trust them. It's a bit like in terms of you smoking nicotine, which can be a good drug if we put them into the clinical trials that antidepressants got put into, nicotine would show less side effects and would show just as great benefits for people who are anxious as the SSRIs do, okay? So there wouldn't be any of the heart attacks or the lung cancers. They wouldn't show up in these trials, okay? Compared to them, SSRIs, compared to nicotine, SSRIs would look worse, okay? Now, we let you manage your own risks on nicotine, but we figured when it got to the point that it looked like, we weren't absolutely sure, but it looked like kind of smoking could cause lung cancer, we begin to put very clear warnings on it, okay, to help you manage those risks. It's still your choice, but you're in the business of managing the risks, okay? Now, when they make nicotine or SSRIs available through me, I have to get a clear message, a bit like, you know, the thing that's on the packet of kind of cigarettes, a very clear message. That's not there. So you may have a good doctor, you may have a person you like, a person who you can talk about all sorts of things to. When it comes to a hazard like this, they're almost as much in the dark as you are, maybe even more in the dark, because they don't want to think they've given you a pill. Well, they don't want to be shown up as being awfully naive. They should be on top of all this, and they aren't. So it's very difficult. Plus, a further thing. A good doctor these days used to be a doctor who listened to you, who looked at you, okay? And we often talk in terms of things like continuity of care. You want to see the same person each time rather than a completely different person who is looking at the computer to find out what the last person said or maybe didn't actually say. But it's really not necessarily having the same person there the whole time. The way health services work, you've got a computer, there's a record there from the last time around. Do you need the same person? We've got the same data. Won't that do? And it's not that. It's much more, it's not having just a nice face who you're interested in football and they'll talk to you about football, okay? It's someone who can learn, who listens to you and learns things about you, okay? And maybe can recognize that there's something different about the way you walked in and things like that. It's that's the key thing. It's rather than just a computer there, it's having a person in a relationship with you who can learn critical things about what's actually going on in you. And that's what we've lost. And yeah, so I think the big thing is it's been a change over 30 years from being able to trust the journals, been able to trust the doctor. I mean, there's always been bad doctors, but roughly speaking, been able to trust the other person that you go to. And it isn't just that. It's if you go a little bit offline, if you go along to anyone else for maybe counseling or health advice, nurse, pharmacist, clinical psychologist, any of these, and they may figure, hey, this dude's on something that's not suiting him, but they will be too scared to mention it. They will figure that it's going to cost them their job if they mention to you that I think this pill isn't suiting you. If you go to a suicide helpline, they can't ask you, did you go on an antidepressant recently? They'll all be told, that's the practice of medicine, and you on a suicide helpline, you're not trained to do that. There's an atmosphere of fear. A lot of people are actually quite scared to talk out about the fact that these pills may not be perfect. And it's a bit like the Catholic Church. If you talked out about at the sacrament and said they aren't perfect, you risk the Inquisition or being excommunicated or things like that. That's religion. But we're dealing with a bunch of pills which can cause problems. If we can't talk about the problems, it's a real issue. And for doctors, a good doctor these days is one who keeps to the guidelines, keeps to the standards of care, which are based on the ghostwritten literature with no access to the clinical trial data. So increasingly, you're at risk from a good doctor, or what gets called a good doctor these days.
It does seem like there is this widening split amongst doctors where some of them really get this stuff and they're really cautious about what they prescribe. And on the other side, there's people who just increasingly trust the system, for lack of a better way to put it, and they just don't question it at all. And each of those sides are kind of criticizing each other. It's become quite messy. And that's why I think your work is so important. Earlier, you mentioned how SSRIs might be associated with suicidal ideation, and there's some confusion around that. There's also this big question that I know you've talked about in a webinar around a possible connection between SSRIs and maybe even homicidal tendencies.
Yeah, no, they can cause it. I mean, when I say cause, what we're talking about is the SSRIs may suit loads of people. And just because you're on an SSRI and you kill someone doesn't mean the SSRI has caused you to do it. But they don't suit all people. They can make some people disinhibited, badly disinhibited, and they make some people akathisic, agitated. And when you become agitated, you start having thoughts about doing things that you wouldn't normally have. And these thoughts can be about killing yourself or killing others. Those kind of thoughts come into your head as well. And when I say thoughts, people think, oh, ideas, that sounds a bit trivial. You can control your thoughts. It's not. It's something more like urges. It's not necessarily the kind of thing you can control all that well. And so there's no question in my mind, but the clinical trial evidence and lots of the cases I've seen show that there are people who can become homicidal on an SSRI. There are people who are in jail now, and it's almost for certain that the SSRI has caused them to kill a person. And it isn't just SSRIs. There's a load of different pills that can do these things, but that the pill has caused the problem, and we should be able to take that into account. But until...
Hey, if you're someone with big health goals but find yourself struggling to get started, or maybe you used to be on top of things but you've fallen off track, you're not alone, and you don't have to settle for generic health advice. At Avantia Health Optimization, we design each plan specifically for you and your unique goals. Forget all the cookie-cutter programs. We'll create a roadmap that fits your lifestyle and ambitions. In your very first $1 session, you'll be working directly with me, a board-certified health and wellness coach, as we dive right in together, mapping out a personalized plan that can cover everything from exercise and nutrition to sleep, stress, circadian health, time management, and more. Wherever you're starting from, we're here to take you from surviving to thriving. Get ready to reclaim your health journey by going to AvantiaHealthOptimization.com. You could also go to MikeVera.com. That's probably a lot easier. Or you can click the link in the show notes. Now back to the show.
But until recently, lots of countries and lots of states in the United States wouldn't let you argue that the drug could cause the problem. So that's one problem. The next problem is most people believe FDA wouldn't let a drug on the market that could cause homicide. FDA have let drugs on the market where the company documents have shown clearly our drug can cause people to become homicidal. Okay, so FDA do let things like this on the market. Lots of people, if we have a jury trying to work out, did your claim is that your drug caused you to kill this person, they're going to look at the academic literature and say, is there any evidence for it there? And there isn't going to be any evidence. In clinical trials, people may have become homicidal. They may have waved guns around threatening to kill people. But when the data goes to FDA, those patients vanish. Okay? So unless you know this, you're not going to have an expert who will be able to say to the jury, well, look, FDA do let these drugs on the market and people have become homicidal in these trials and here's how they vanished. If you don't have an expert who who knows that, well, you're in a tricky kind of position. And then there's the next little bit, which is you might have found a really nice doctor, someone whom you got on with well, and it may be very obvious to him that the drug is the only way to explain the fact that you became homicidal and killed your kids or whatever. But he's going to be told by his lawyer, if you blame the drug and this person gets off, the doctor, may be faced with a charge of involuntary homicide.
Wow.
So most doctors aren't going to have the courage to stick to their guns and say, I can see no other reason to explain how this person went on to kill a third party other than the drug caused it. They got agitated in this drug. We ought to have changed it earlier. And they said awful things were going to happen. Like James Holmes, the Batman killer. Do you recall the Holmes case? The Aurora case, the opening night of the Batman movie.
Yeah, the mass shooter.
James Holmes was on Zoloft, and he ended up killing 12 people and seriously injuring 72 others. In Holmes's case, he gets put on Zoloft. It isn't actually suiting him. He changes from being shy and inhibited to being disinhibited and flirting with girls and buying guns and buying a big motorbike. Complete change of personality. Keeps a diary saying, I've got this manic delirium. I mean, he outlines in the diary that things are actually going wrong in this pill. He goes to his doctor and he says, if you knew the thoughts I was having in my head, you'd lock me up. And she looks at him and says, you're responsible for the thoughts in your head. She was responsible for the thoughts in his head. And he ends up, the defense team, he gets a public defender, who isn't being paid much. And for them, victory is if he doesn't get the death penalty. And my sense is that the prosecution and the defense team came to an agreement that he will be convicted and he gets a 3,000-year sentence or whatever it is, but he won't be executed. They'll get one juror to say, yes, he's guilty, but, I don't think he should be executed. And they don't mention the pill at all. They try to convince the jury that he had a mental illness. Well, this guy didn't have a mental illness. He shouldn't have been put on the SSRI at all, ever. So that's the kind of scenario you can end up in. And people aren't being told that there are these risks around the place. And it isn't when we talk about informed consent. When you go on an SSRI, you should be told there's a risk they aren't going to suit you and you might become suicidal. And your partner should be told there's a risk these pills aren't going to suit him and he may kill you or someone else. You need to keep your eye out for any change in personality. It's a bit like the sex issues that when you go on an SSRI, they can inhibit your ability to make love. They make you genitally numb from the first pill. You're not told this. You can check the label of the drug and it'll talk about genital dysesthesia. Does anyone know what that word means? Very few, And you're not told that it's actually going to affect pretty well everyone. And the other thing is your partner's not told. I mean, it may be just as important for her as it is for you that this actually explains what's going on. He's not actually falling out of love with me or whatever. Or she may feel, look, I need you not to be on these pills. We need to have a conversation.
Yeah.
She and you are not going to be told that your sperm count is going to go through the floor. You're not going to be able to have a baby from the male point of view. Or if it's her who's on the pills, there's a real risk she's not going to be able to carry the pregnancy the whole way through. Neither of you are told that, and the country isn't being told. We've got a reproductive replacement rate that has gone way, way down. So the United States, the original population, is not replacing itself. We, and in Europe, all Western countries these days need immigrants because we're not producing the populations that we had to keep filling the jobs and paying the taxes and keeping the system going. We need immigrants, and then people give out about the immigrants. These things need a national conversation that we're just not having.
Hmm. Yeah, I know. Like, so I'm hearing that a lot of these people aren't being told about the risks. And even publicly, when something happens, like the mass shooter that you mentioned, one of the first questions a lot of people bring up is, were they on SSRIs? And because of the messy situation we're in with all this, it's often just dismissed as a crazy conspiracy theory, which is unfortunate because it sounds like there is some reason to believe that it could very well be the case. And when I read your book, I know that we actually in 2012, when your book came out, we started approaching this shift in the market. And I started really going all in on researching drugs like ketamine, which is now more popular than it was then. And there does seem, even though SSRIs are still being prescribed, there does seem to be this shift towards drugs like ketamine, and even other psychedelics are being studied as to how they might affect depression. Ketamine in particular, in the beginning, when they were talking about this, it was presented as an alternative because you can take it once and you'll be good for 6 months or so and you won't need another treatment again. And here we are today where they put it in like Flonase bottles where you can use it regularly. And I was kind of disappointed by that. But I guess, what's your take on that shift that seems to be moving towards this psychedelic approach towards certain psychiatric illnesses?
Yeah, and that's not completely crazy, okay? Now, when we talk about a shift, it's a talk in the media. It's a talk, there's articles out there, but there's not a huge increase in the number of people on the pills, and there's not a big fall in the number of people taking the SSRIs. In fact, year on year, there's more and more people on SSRIs than ever before, partly because each year, there's a huge number of people who have been put on them and can't get off them. I mean, it's not that we're giving more and more of them. It's we end up with more and more people on them because we've got more and more people who are on them and can't get off. Okay? So, and part of the problem with the psychedelics and ketamine is we can't get you off the SSRI to give you ketamine, maybe. Now, it may or may not suit you. Go on to that now in just a moment. But for sure, ketamine is not a problem, or is not an answer, and psilocybin isn't an answer to the problems SSRIs cause, the inability to get off them. So when you start mixing a bunch of drugs, I mean, if you could swap cleanly from one to the other, that would be one thing, but we can't. In terms of the mushrooms and things like that, do they all work? The answer is, for some people, they do. They're clearly not going to work for all people. And ketamine in a Flonase bottle isn't going to work either. It's certainly not going to be a once-off treatment that will put you right for 6 months, because that won't suit industry's interest.
Right.
They want you to be on a pill for life, and they want to be getting an income from it. As Goldman Sachs said a few years ago, curing people is not a good business model. They want you to be on stuff for life. And the problem with high-dose ketamine as opposed to the nasal spray is, yes, it can work awfully effectively if you're very severely depressed. If you're just not feeling good and things like that, then it's a completely different beast. But there are some people who can be awfully severely depressed that ketamine on a once-off basis can make a big difference to. Not all people, but there'll be some whom it can actually make a big difference to, okay? So that's always been the issue. From an industry point of view, that hasn't looked like a good idea. So they're in the business of trying to put it in a low dose in a Flonase bottle that they can make some off every time you squirt up your nose or whatever. And they know that it's not really going to make a big difference, so you feel so good that you won't need to take any more for the next half year. So, yeah. So with all these things, it's I think one of the other things to bring out is just the fact that we're all different. An SSRI may suit you and may not suit me. And one of the best stories of all time, I think, is that Arvid Carlson, the man who made the first SSRI, figured that this thing can chill people out. It's not a great antidepressant, but it does have a chill pill kind of action. It's going to suit some people and it's not going to suit all. I mean, from his point of view, it was like LSD. LSD will suit some people, and not others. SSRIs are going to be the same. They don't fix anything. They'll suit some people. They won't suit others, okay? And it ends up that the SSRIs are among the pills you use most frequently for people who've got obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm. And Carlson was quite good. He came up with the idea of an SSRI because he listened to people. And some of the older drugs were serotonin reuptake inhibiting, and he heard people say, this pill as opposed to that one has more of a chill pill effect. That's where he got the idea from. He listened to people with OCD who were on SSRI, some of whom said, look, your SSRI just doesn't suit me. Nicotine suits me better. When I take up smoking, I do much better on nicotine, okay? And he thought, that's interesting. Let's run a trial. And he ran a trial and ended up saying, for lots of people with OCD, nicotine is much better than an SSRI. This is the man who had created the idea of an SSRI, you know. But it actually comes back. The discoveries are made from listening to people, from trusting the people. If people come along and tell you things, they don't have much incentive to lie. Sure, there's going to be people who are lying, who are trying to game the system, but most people aren't. If they're actually having a problem on a pill, what's the incentive to lie? There's none.
I do think of the veterans who, a lot of them are depressed after they go to battle. A lot of them have PTSD. They're predisposed to suicidal ideation already. And in many cases, I believe they're put on SSRIs, which what might make those suicidal ideations worse. And then again, I've personally spoken with veterans who have tried something like mushrooms or maybe even ketamine, and they find that they're a lot better off and they maybe don't need to take these things regularly. So hopefully we are able to get this sorted out somehow at some point. But to take a little bit of a shift here, I'm wondering if you noticed any types of manipulative or propaganda tactics during the COVID years.
Yeah, okay. That's a big question. And I think some years ago, I mean, yeah, when I said Goldman Sachs said curing people is not a good business model, okay? What they had in mind was drugs that cured AIDS, that kept people alive. There's terrible pressure on the industry to bring the price of those drugs down so that people don't die. Whereas if we're treating you for your cholesterol levels or your bone densities or your blood sugars, they're just risk factors. And we can, you're actually going to have those till the day you die, maybe. And you can have loads of risk factors, so we can have you on a bunch of different drugs every day from here till the day you die, which is going to be earlier if you're on a bunch of different pills. But the industry began making a huge amount of money from treating risk factors. Okay, so it came as a big surprise to me. Oh, roughly maybe 10 years ago, looking at industry talk about the things that are in the pipeline. And what they were saying was that we've got 200 or 300 vaccines in the pipeline. And I'm there thinking, there aren't 200 or 300 viruses in the place that I can think of. What on earth's happening here? Okay. And the answer is that they were going to have vaccines for different viruses, sure, and for cancers. And for drug abuse, cocaine abuse was going to completely vanish because they were going to have a vaccine for it. The ideal time for vaccine is during pregnancy or early infancy. If we give you a vaccine later in life, there's a greater chance that we're going to see you were normal before you got it and you're injured now. But, you know, if you give it to an infant, who can tell that the vaccine actually caused a problem or not? We don't know what normal was for this infant. So, yeah, so the COVID thing, I mean, what happened about 10 years ago as well was industry developed some platforms for what we now recognize as the mRNA and DNA vaccines and the RSV vaccine.
Hey folks, just a quick pause on our discussion today because I have something important to share. You know that I'm always in front of screens, and that artificial light can be disruptive to the circadian rhythm, and that can impact your health pretty severely. So that's why I wear Bond Charge blue light blocking glasses. It's not just a stylish accessory, but it's really a daily defense against
eye strain, headaches, disrupted sleep schedules, and really that circadian rhythm that I'm trying to protect. So it does protect your eyes. It does improve your sleep. It does help maintain your circadian health. And honestly, I've experienced fewer headaches and just a better overall sense of my health. I feel healthier when I wear these. And yeah, they do look cool as well. I get compliments all the time, especially when I wear them out at a restaurant or something like that. So for those who are looking to boost their health in this digital age, I've got some good news. As part of the Healthy and Awake community, you can get 15% off by going to the show notes, clicking the affiliate link, and using the coupon code Healthy and Awake with dashes. So that's Healthy dash and dash awake. And you can get 15% off of these very cool Bond Charge blue light blocking glasses. And that's a great way to enhance your daily health routine and your style. Now let's dive back into the episode.
Have you guys heard about the respiratory syncytial virus vaccine? Well, things are
all plenty.
So that's where industry figured they could make an awful lot of money. And with all these things, it's not like the old vaccines. You had a polio vaccine or a measles vaccine, and that kept you fine for life. These are ones which, like the flu vaccine, you need to top them up each year. And we're going to ensure your mum gets it when she's pregnant with you, or you get it for the first day of life and things like that. And it's a little bit like kind of sex. Let me explain. Back in Victorian times, ladies used to have dresses which went down right to the floor. You could see nothing. They were covered from here all the way down. Okay, now we kind of complain these days about people wearing the burqa and things like that, but it was a bit right. Like that during Victorian times for all of us. And then you'd find a big scandal because, you know, the dresses came up to the knee and they were showing a bit of leg. And then they went up higher and things like that, and things got trimmed here and there, and a big kind of scandal when it got trimmed first. But we kind of get used to it. We don't see it anymore. We've got a bunch of drugs called monoclonal antibodies, MABs, these days, and they've been rebranded as vaccines. Now, monoclonal antibodies can be awfully effective. If you give them to people who've got a severe problem, you can really make a big difference. But they interfere with your immune system. They can give you, in effect, an AIDS-like problem. You end up with all kinds of infections that you don't get if you don't take the monoclonal antibody. You can get kind of tumors you wouldn't otherwise take. We are now giving RSV monoclonal antibodies to infants at birth. Mothers aren't being told monoclonal antibodies are tricky drugs. They're being told this is going to prevent RSV, which sounds good. But, you know, we've lost the sense of kind of, you're asking me to do what? That's gone. Oh, just have this shot and everything will be okay. And if it isn't, somehow we just don't hear you complain anymore. And you aren't going to be compensated because it's a vaccine and there's no compensation system for injuries on a vaccine.
Wow. Yeah, I spoke with Dr. Peter McCullough, who maybe you're aware of, and he's expressed similar concerns as well. I would encourage people to have a healthy sense of skepticism with everything going on that's being pushed on us nowadays. But of course, people want to trust their doctors. You know, well, that's who they look to.
Absolutely. It's a bit like the church. You know, you want to trust the system. And in particular, the system says it's built on science, but it's not. So
what advice do you have for people who want to make the healthiest decisions? Maybe they do trust their doctors. They hear this episode. Now they're a little uncertain. What advice do you have for the regular people out there?
We need to get to grips with the fact that the system's broken. It did work. It was pretty good till about 30 years ago or so. We have let it get to the point that it's at now. okay? And people need to realize it. They need to begin to say it isn't a good idea that all these articles are ghostwritten. It isn't a good idea that FDA don't actually get the data from the trials that the other companies do. We, in terms of the doctors you have to trust, they're potentially doing themselves out of a job. If the pills work so well and are free of problems, then nurses can give them and they're cheaper to employ. And pharmacists can give them and they're also cheaper to employ. So doctors need to wake up and smell the coffee, because if the pills work, I mean, it used to be the case 30 odd years ago, the magic lay in me. And part of the thing was I had pills that I could turn to. Now everybody's trained to think the magic lies in the pill. And if the magic lies in the pill, we don't need expensive doctors. So I think things have got to the point where the system can keep going the way it is. Life expectancy in the United States in particular, but also in Western Europe, is falling. It can maybe fall a bit further, but there will actually come a point where people begin to ask, what the hell's going on here? And I'm not sure industry propaganda will be able to keep us from recognizing that the pills are playing a part in all this.
So then what advice do you have for the doctors? Many of them listen to the show. I would encourage them again to read your books, all of them, but start with Pharmageddon. That one's my favorite. So what advice do you have for the doctors themselves?
Well, I've talked about, do antidepressants cause people to commit suicide? Doctors vaguely listen, but don't really pay too much heed. The only thing that I've ever felt they've listened to is me saying, if these pills work as well as you've been told and are as free of problems as you've been told, you're going out of business. That's the thing that they wake up to a little bit. Now, it does take a bit of courage, because increasingly, if you're going to recognize that the pills cause a problem, you're going to be going against the standard of care. And the people who run the health service business that you're working in may figure that this guy's not keeping to the standards of care. This is dangerous. We're going to have to get rid of him. So that's the problem doctors are up against. But, you know, it's becoming a case of, do I get sacked today or do I get sacked tomorrow, basically. So.
Okay. I have just a few questions left because I know we're almost at time. This next one maybe sounds a little bit silly, but if you had a magic wand and you can use it to fix the status quo that we're in, what's like one to three things that you might use that magic wand to change?
Yeah, we need regulators and companies and everybody to realize that risk communication can't be about just deterring people from, I mean, can't be about conceding the hazards of pills to avoid people being deterred from using them. If doctors manage risk because the drugs are available on prescription only, they need to know what the hazards are and they need to have it spelled out. They can't be told vague things like the treatment of depression can maybe cause people to commit suicide. They need to be told the pills might be causing it in very clear language. Okay. These days, the Catholic Church recognizes that gluten in the Eucharist can cause problems. So when it comes to the sacraments, they're more real world than a lot of doctors are these days. So that's a thing that actually needs to change. That's the big thing that needs to change. The other thing is the person who comes to a doctor, the questions they have been asking are, am I being told about the rest of these pills? Am I giving informed consent? And what we need is something a bit more like, pills are pills. There's a chemical there, but what makes them medicines is the information that goes with them and how much the doctor knows about the information and how they're going to respond to this. Okay, so if you're going to give informed consent to be treated by me, it's not what does the pill do. You need to be asking the question, who are you? I mean, you need to be asking me, who am I? And you need to get a sense of, when things go wrong, when you tell me things have gone wrong, am I likely to believe you or not? If it looks like I'm not likely to believe you, you need a different doctor.
And I do work with a lot of clients who struggle with medications of all kinds. And it's been disappointing to hear that very often they say, my doctor doesn't listen to me, or I express these concerns about medications, and they kind of just dismiss those ideas altogether. So yeah, finding a good doctor you can trust and asking questions and being on top of these things is very important. Dr. Healy, David, is there anything else that we have not yet talked about today that maybe we should?
Yeah, just based on what you've just said, doctors need to realize, and you need to realize too, that my life and our lives could be a lot more fun if I just believe you. For instance, what you get with the sexual problems that people have on the SSRI group of drugs is that you've got people who can hold the SSRI and they're left gently numb, even more gently numb than they were on the pills. And there's people that go along to doctors and let them know, this is what's actually happened to me. I can't feel a thing. I can get a hard bristle brush and rub it up and down my genitals and feel nothing. Doctors say, that's crazy. This pill is out of your body. That's a crazy idea. And I'm going to lock you up in hospital and treat you with an antipsychotic. That happens. Okay.
That's now, terrifying.
It is. But the thing about it is, look, this is such a strange thing. I need to listen to you and I need to work with you, because life becomes a lot more interesting when I start thinking as well, how on earth could a pill be causing this? And for the last 10 years, one of the most interesting things that I've been doing is just listening to people who've got what's called post-SSRI sexual dysfunction, PSSD. And it's been absolutely fascinating to realize how little we know about these pills, how many people are actually affected, to recognize that there were people who have been on the pills, people who I used to call patients, but now call research assistants. They're doing all the research, finding out things that I didn't ever know. And the job becomes a lot more interesting. Fun for me, not really fun for them because they have a problem, but at least better when they have a person like me that they can work with rather than a person who says, I'm going to lock you up because that's a crazy idea. So it's a better world if we just work together on these things. And that's the kind of thing that isn't happening these days in a way that it used to happen more.
David, where can people find out more about you and what you do?
I've got an adverse event reporting website called risk.org. That's RXISK.org. That's probably the best place to go. There is also a place called davidhealy.org where they can see a blog and things like that.
Yeah, I highly encourage people to check out both of those sites. I will put them in the show notes, as well as the webinar I mentioned in the beginning of this conversation on the possible association between SSRIs and homicidal ideation. So please check that out. My audience, you guys know, I've had some amazing guests on here, people who have millions of followers. They've been on Joe Rogan, but I cannot tell you enough. Dr. Healy here is seriously like the person you have to take a deep dive into. So please check out his work, but also stay healthy, stay awake. Hey, thanks for listening to this episode of Healthy and Awake Podcast. Please remember to leave us a 5-star rating on Spotify or Apple, or if you're watching this on Rumble or YouTube, please be sure to give us a thumbs up and leave a comment down below. Let us know what you thought, or if you had any questions based on what we talked about in this episode. And of course, it couldn't hurt to share it with your friends, those who maybe are awake, or those, of course, who are waking up. Thanks again. Stay healthy, stay awake.